Today is Friday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump closes out the final night of the Republican National Convention with a warning about what might happen if Joe Biden wins the election.
Biden being called a socialist, essentially, or that he's in the pocket of the socialists, and the country will no longer be safe if he's elected.
The Trump administration hints at a vaccine while health experts express concern.
Until you run the study to completion, you still really can't be sure that a vaccine is able to do either.
Also ahead, the National Basketball Association says it hopes to resume playoffs in a few days following players' protests against racial injustice. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump delivered his official nomination acceptance speech on the fourth and final day of the Republican National Convention Thursday. Ivanka Trump, along with other Trump allies, also gave speeches ahead of the president. Joining us now for more on the final night of the convention is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, what exactly were the main messages being conveyed by the president and the RNC overall this week?
The main message from the speakers during the week of the Republican National Convention, including the president, is essentially, if you want to see America stay America, then you need to reelect the incumbent president. Biden being called a socialist, essentially, or that he's in the pocket of the socialists, and the country will no longer be safe if he's elected. There weren't a lot of specifics provided about what they foresee as the dangers that would be caused by a change of administration. And also, we had a lack of what we would usually see from a president running, an outline specifically of what he would be doing in the next 4 years. Instead, it was basically a message that, you know, we've kept this country together for the past 4 years. And if Donald Trump had not been in charge, a lot of things, including the coronavirus pandemic, would have been a lot worse. Democrats, of course, totally rejecting that, saying that what the president and the Republicans have been saying is ridiculous. And the current situation that we see in the United States with the coronavirus pandemic having killed more than 180,000 people, more than any other country in the world, and the racial unrest is all on Donald Trump. And you cannot blame this on Joe Biden and the Democrats.
Now, the event at the White House in itself drew some sharp concerns and criticism from, particularly from Democrats, the legality or ethics of it. And also, we saw, looked like, over 1,000 people at the White House for this address. You mentioned pandemic. Were there concerns about that? Or was this sending a message that he wants to portray things are relatively back to normal?
Certainly, to some extent. And as far as the concerns about the ethics of these sort of events that we've seen all week long involving the White House and other federal properties, the White House contends that nothing they're doing violates what's known as the Hatch Act, which separates the federal government and its employees from political events. The president and vice president are exempt from that. They're saying that employees were not violating this rule. And although the use of the White House as a political prop is not unprecedented, we've really not seen it used in this manner to this extent before. Now, when it comes to the 1,000-plus people that were on the South Lawn for the president's acceptance speech, what the White House is saying is that they consulted with experts and they feel that proper precautions have been made, so this would not be a super spreader event for the coronavirus. But a lot of people looking at this event were obviously concerned because the seats were so close together and many people were not wearing masks and they're cheering. Thus, if they're infected with the virus, that would be spreading the virus around. This is very similar to the event we saw in Tulsa, Oklahoma some months ago that really caused the president to tone down his rally type of events. So there is concern but the White House is not among the places where that concern is being shared, at least publicly.
Earlier in the day, the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, and his running mate, Kamala Harris, had some pretty scathing words. They took the opportunity to do what we call a pre-buttal, basically going after what they pretty much assumed the president was going to try to say to attack them. I know you attended that as well. Can you tell us a little bit about their overall message and what they had to say?
Well, there were two different events. One was with former Vice President Biden holding a virtual event, and he criticized the president, pushing back on the criticism, and also really was expressing his upset with holding a purely political event on the White House lawn, saying that Trump was virtually throwing every major rule in the dustbin. Now, who we did see in person was Senator Kamala Harris, the running mate for the former vice president. She spoke in a university auditorium, and there were only a few dozen journalists in the audience besides campaign staff and security, but the event was live streamed and picked up by some media. This was really one of the most scathing and detailed criticisms that we have seen by the Democratic ticket of President Trump, and especially of his handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
He was convinced that if his administration focused on this virus, it would hurt the market and hurt his chances of being reelected. That mattered to him more than saving American lives.
Some other things that Harris also said, she accused Donald Trump of freezing when confronted with the pandemic, saying, quote, he was scared and he was petty and vindictive. She also said that Biden has had a plan for months to combat COVID-19, while President Trump still does not have a plan, adding, you can't stop it with a tweet.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. The National Basketball Association said Thursday it hopes to resume play in a day or two after a boycott by players protesting against racial injustice and police brutality, while President Trump denounced the league as acting like a political organization. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
A day after the league postponed three playoff games as players demand action on racial injustice, Pence Chief of Staff Mark Short called the protest absurd and silly, telling CNN, if they want to protest, I don't think we care. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner tells CNBC NBA players are very fortunate to be in the financial situation where they can take a night off from work without facing financial consequences. Kushner separately told Politico he plans to reach out to LeBron James, an outspoken advocate for policing change. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Meanwhile, a teenager arrested and charged in the shootings in Wisconsin that led to the death of two people and injury of another faces six criminal counts, including first-degree intentional homicide. On Tuesday night, when armed militia members clashed with protesters in the city, the protests started after Jacob Blake was shot multiple times in the back by a police officer Sunday afternoon in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Both political parties are watching the developments in Wisconsin and cities across the nation, with Republicans leaning hard on support for law and order, with no words offered for Black victims of police violence. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has called for police reform and getting to the root of the issues. In his convention address Wednesday night, Vice President Mike Pence blamed Democrats for the violence.
Just as our nation had begun to recover, we've seen violence and chaos in the streets of our major cities. President Trump and I will always support the right of Americans to peaceful protest. But rioting and looting is not peaceful protest. Tearing down statues is not free speech. And those who do so will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Joining us now for more on the racial reckoning that is happening in America is attorney Puneet Shima, manager of policing reform with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The Trump administration doesn't seem to feel there is an issue of racial injustice, but rather is trying to drive home a message of law and order and taking a tough stance.
The law and order approaches to policing are exactly what have led us to where we are today. They are the types of approaches and strategies that have led to mass incarceration, disparities in stop searches and arrests, to unjustified stop searches and arrests, to excessive force disproportionately against people of color. The protesters on the street have made clear what needs to change. And we who have been working on policing reforms and have seen what hasn't worked. No, training has not changed officer activity to the extent that it should have. Policing needs to dramatically change. The system of public safety needs to dramatically change. Jacob Blake was resolving a dispute between two people. There was no reason for that to result in armed officers coming to a scene and shooting him in the back. There are so many interpersonal disputes that do not require or should not have the involvement of armed people whose only resources are handcuffs and weapons.
What about these so-called armed militias that are forming? It would appear they are part of, some of them anyway, are part of some sort of white supremacy movement.
These militias have existed for some time. And there's also a deeply disturbing relationship between armed groups and law enforcement that we've seen throughout the history of the U.S. That needs to be examined. So it's not only problematic that these militias feel bold enough to walk the streets and protest and know that they won't be stopped or questioned by law enforcement. And as we saw, I think Tuesday night, before the 17-year-old shot the protesters, some law enforcement officers are encouraging them, saying, "We appreciate you," making sure they're hydrated. That's a real problem that needs to be addressed.
Certainly the young man was walking in the middle of the street with an automatic weapon around his shoulder with his hands up after the shooting, and we saw a video of a number of police vehicles driving right by him, apparently not alarmed by that, not picking up on the fact that his hands were up and that he was apparently trying to surrender.
And that is exactly why this is not about law and order. There's a different way that he is treated after, you know, he is armed and walking in the middle of the street, and that's why it's not about law and order, but to whom the law applies and what order is required based on the color of your skin.
Is your organization doing anything as far as legally regarding this or other incidents like it?
Our campaign works in cities and states and at the federal level. We do advocacy work. We do legislative and policy work at every level.
Do you think if the Trump administration gets 4 more years that their law and order policies will lead to the end of these protests or more violence?
It certainly won't lead to the end of these protests. What we've seen from the history of policing in the past is that unless there is a fundamental change in the ways that cities and governments approach public safety, police violence and police brutality, particularly targeted at people of color and Black communities, will continue. And so that fundamental change needs to happen. Otherwise, we're going to see it happen over and over.
If there is, in fact, systemic racism in the country and some police, not all, of course, are potentially treating people of color differently in their approach, is it a matter of training? How do you address something like that may be just built into a person in their views?
The problem is that it's not just the person, it's the system. It's built into the way that cities police and govern their communities. And it's not just policing, it's inextricably linked to the lack of resources provided to communities of color. It stems from the ways that cities have been segregated before we had protections from housing segregation. It stems from all the ways that Black communities have been deprived of resources. And so it has to be not a solution that is solely within the realm of police departments. The solution has to be to provide the resources that communities have left. For the last decades, we've invested far too much in policing as if that will solve the problem, when the underlying problem has been the disparities in the ways that Black communities are given resources and the disparate strategies that are used in those communities that have been under-resourced.
Puneet Chima, Manager of Policing Reform with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thank you for being with us. Hurricane Laura ripped through Louisiana Thursday, killing 4 people who were crushed by falling trees and igniting a chemical plant fire that sent a chlorine-infused plume of smoke into the sky 15 hours after landfall. While still creating major destruction, the storm caused less mayhem than forecasters had predicted. At a briefing at the Federal Emergency Management Agency headquarters Thursday, President Trump said he'd been prepared to postpone his speech at the Republican convention.
Turned out we got a little bit lucky. It was very big, it was very powerful, but it passed quickly. And so everything's on schedule. We'll probably be going on Saturday or Sunday, and we'll be heading to Texas and Louisiana.
Hundreds of thousands remain without power in three states, and officials said it would take days to assess the overall damage. A U.S. doctors group is calling for transparency in COVID-19 vaccine development. The American Medical Association said Wednesday the rapid pace of vaccine development and scant information about the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's vaccine review process are leading to concerns. In a letter, the AMA urged the FDA to ensure transparency in the development process and to keep physicians informed of the agency's plan to review potential vaccine candidates. Joining us is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, bioethicist at New York Langone Medical Center. Thanks for being with us. The Trump administration has been hinting at the possibility of a vaccine approval ahead of the November election. What in the medical community is causing concern?
The data might show some efficacy and might show some safety, but until you run the study to completion, you still really can't be sure that a vaccine is able to do either. So my specific concerns about approving any vaccine before a trial is finished, while something may look suggestive if you've run the trial halfway, it's not uncommon that side effects, dangerous things, or what looked like a bump in efficacy turns out to not hold until you get all the way done. So you're trying to do studies on big groups of people, 20, 30, 50,000 subjects. You've got a placebo group and people getting the active agent. And even if after 5,000 subjects, something seems to be giving a little bit more protection and doesn't seem to have side effects, you really can't tell if that's going to be true until you run really the whole study to the end. Because the more people you test in, the more likely it is that you may hit a side effect, or what looked like it was protective was only protective for a few tiny number of people but didn't really give much protection overall. The last problem is as soon as you announce when it's a vaccine, that it's prematurely approved. It's one thing to take a medicine before it's fully approved. If you're dying of cancer and you figure, if this thing looks like it might help, I'll try it. It's a different thing to be healthy and say they rushed the approval of the vaccine. A lot of people, polls are showing numbers like 40%, are not going to take it. They're just going to say, you know what, I feel fine. I'll keep wearing my mask. I'm not taking a vaccine that could wind up making me sick. So even if you approve it more quickly on limited evidence, what that says to a lot of people is, that's not safe enough. I'm not using it.
Does the FDA have to do what the president says as far as releasing things before they feel that they're ready to be released?
Well, that's a good question. Historically, the FDA has been pretty independent, and as recently as about a week ago, they looked at the same data and did not want to issue a emergency waiver for blood plasma. But Trump and the administration brought pressure on them privately and publicly. Trump was tweeting that they were in the way, they were being obstructionist, they were the deep state, as he likes to say, meaning bureaucracy, holding up big breakthroughs. And since the FDA commissioner is a political appointment, I think they feel the heat. So they're not as independent as maybe they ought to be. And it's clear to me that the same data that led them initially to say no to the idea of an emergency use waiver got pushed back by the president.
Do you still believe it will be late next year before we actually have a potentially have a solid tested vaccine?
I do. I think it's going to take us till late next year to have a confirmed efficacious vaccine. Maybe, by the way, only 40 to 50% effective, but even to get that, I think it's going to take till late next year. And I say that because you recruit all the people, but then you've got to wait for them to be infected to see whether the experimental vaccine helps or not. And so that just takes time. If you're in a hot spot, that's great. But if the virus begins to go away, either because people wear their masks or because we just get lucky and it diminishes, it's slower to see who gets infected. But even if you get data and it looks like there's benefit of some kind to the vaccine, you still have to make it. You still have to ship it. A lot of these vaccines are two doses, which is technically in the U.S. alone a big, big challenge. You know, there's 300 million or so of us, and you need 600 million doses. If it's a two-shot vaccine, it requires refrigeration, and it requires distribution. For those reasons, I think you're in a pipeline that's just going to be not as fast as this fall. And I should add, listeners can imagine, if it is 600 million doses just for the U.S., forget about what other countries get or might want to receive, when did we ever make 600 million of anything perfectly? My answer to that is never. There's going to be factory glitches, safety slowdowns. It's not going to roll out smoothly, 600 million doses. It's going to take some time.
Even with all of these different tests going on, there's some of them are in phase three.
Yeah. Look, they're just starting phase three, and that's the recruitment of the 20, 30, 50,000 people. Once you get them signed up, you have to get them vaccinated. Once they get vaccinated, then you have to wait to see who gets infected naturally. As I said, if the virus goes away or those people still wear masks and engage in protective behavior, it's going to be slow to see whether the vaccine works, because the infection rate will be hopefully low. That's what you want. You don't want to give people experimental vaccine and then tell them to throw their masks away and run into bars and go get tattoos and abandon all protective practices. They still have to try not to get infected, because you don't know if the vaccine is going to work.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, bioethicist at New York Langone Medical Center, thank you for being with us. U.S. coalition and Russian military patrols narrowly avoided a serious mishap in the north of Syria Tuesday when vehicles from each side appeared to have tried to outrun each other in a wheat field in northeastern Hasakha province. On Thursday, the U.S. Pentagon, in a statement, strongly condemned what it called, quote, deliberately provocative and aggressive behavior. A small number of U.S. troops reportedly were slightly injured in the minor collision. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab news channels broadcast Russian video of the incident between U.S. and Russian patrols Tuesday, in which American armored vehicles appeared to drive alongside Russian vehicles, with a collision occurring at one point. It was not immediately clear who was to blame. U.S. news outlet Politico reported that four American soldiers were injured. Arab media reported that U.S. troops in one vehicle suffered minor concussions. Syrian state TV, quoting Russian Army Chief of Staff Valery Gerasimov, report that Moscow had informed the U.S. about the movements of its forces before the incident took place. U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Elliott called the Russian vehicle's conduct unsafe and unprofessional, maintaining that their actions represent a breach of deconfliction protocols committed to by the United States and Russia in December 2019. He added, the coalition and the U.S. do not seek escalation with any national military forces, but that U.S. forces always retain the inherent right and obligation to defend themselves from hostile acts. Video on social media from a previous incident between U.S. and Russian forces in May show that at a Russian military checkpoint, U.S. vehicles were prevented from using a highway near the Syrian government-held town of Qamishli. Joshua Landis, who heads the Middle East program at the University of Oklahoma, tells VOA that incidents like the one on Tuesday will surely increase in the future, saying with so many armies and militias all claiming legitimate control of the same small territory, conflict and provocation are to be expected. U.S. President Donald Trump called for the withdrawal of American forces from northeastern Syria in late 2019, following a Turkish offensive against Kurdish forces along the border. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The United States and China traded jibes as military tensions grow between the world's two largest economies, with the U.S. defense chief vowing not to cede an inch in the Pacific and China saying Washington was risking soldiers' lives. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday the Kremlin had set up a police force to support Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko, although it would not be deployed unless unrest spun out of control. The remarks were the strongest signal yet that Russia is prepared to use force if needed in Belarus, where mass demonstrations have continued since an election that the opposition says was rigged to prolong Lukashenko's 26-year rule. And coronavirus cases passed the 7 million mark in Latin America Thursday, even as some countries begin to show a slight decline in infections in a region with the world's highest level of contagion. You're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The ancient art of traditional African storytelling has found an unlikely ally during the COVID-19 pandemic. Because of lockdowns, the Play Africa Children's Museum in South Africa has put its African storytelling project online, broadening the audience to children around the world. Maurice de Klerk has the story from Johannesburg.
She knocked. Professional storyteller Tembile Tsuma has taken traditional African storytelling onto cyberspace. He was supposed to entertain youngsters on location at the Play Africa Children's Museum in Johannesburg, but the pandemic lockdown changed all that. Now Tsuma is performing online through a camera and computer screen. His global exposure has been growing, Tsuma explains via Zoom.
Now I am more than like 3,000 people following me on my page, of which is actually the same thing that's also happening to other storytellers and to the Play Africa page.
Hello, my friends.
Hello.
Hello.
Internet savvy mom Pamela Seluwani from Soweto explains on a Zoom call why she initiated viewing sessions in a local bookshop.
Some kids don't have the opportunity to actually watch even on their phones. They don't have access. So I'm like, why can't I let other kids watch with me? It was from an excitement of discovering this, and I just wanted to make it go viral.
It was a steep learning curve for the storytellers, the Children's Museum and its partner organization, ASIDESH SA, the South African branch of the International Association of Theatre for Children and Young People, to master the technology and adapt techniques and props to bring interactive African storytelling to Facebook Live. However, their efforts have transmitted African story magic far beyond South Africa, despite the COVID-19 lockdown, says Anne Simmons of the Play Africa Children's Museum via Zoom.
That ancient art form is now putting a human and a human together again via some zippy technology. We started seeing people from Kenya and elsewhere in Africa connecting. We often see in Europe, in the UK, families logging on. We've had families from Australia.
Despite clear benefits, online African storytelling must be dealt with carefully going forward, says applied theatre practitioner and analyst Lalu Mokuku through Zoom.
It may also exclude many people that may not have access to a digital space. That's why I said there needs to be care. At the same time, it's also quite important for our stories to be told widely.
Play Africa Children's Museum and ASIDESH SA are working on developing complementary educational content and considering ways for wider use of the stories. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And following in her famous mother's footsteps, singer Lola Lennox has released her first single. The 29-year-old, who is the daughter of singer-songwriter and former Eurythmics star Annie Lennox, has just released the single Back at Wrong. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.